Hello, world singers. My name is Tyler.
And my name is Brooke.
And this is Cosmere Conversations.
With another episode all about the secret projects and connecting them to the Stormlight Archive in anticipation of this year's Stormlight 5 release.
We are so excited. We cannot wait. We have to get after it soon. And that's why we bring you Storming Theories, a wonderfully named series of podcasts when we go out on every limb or retreat back and see what we got wrong when we were originally looking at the secret projects. They came at us hot and fast, and we were going through them so quickly. Now, when we have a little bit of perspective, when we've seen all the secret projects, except that one Brandon snuck in at the last minute, we have a better understanding and hope to gain a better understanding of the secret projects and how they guide us to understanding Stormlight Archive 5.
And how all of these things are connecting, because I think maybe not in Stormlight 5, but certainly immediately subsequently, all of this stuff is really tying together and becoming more and more entwined. And so figuring out all of these connection points is going to start to become both more interesting and more important.
I absolutely agree. Brandon definitely flipped the switch when it came to revealing the greater Cosmere, and we're on the other side of that equation.
Yeah.
And so each time a new aspect is added, a new book is added, we have to incorporate it to what we already know, and then what we're doing now, looking forward to what it could mean for the future of the Cosmere.
I want to start with a topic that we also touched upon in our Tress Theories episode, and I don't think this topic is going anywhere anytime soon. That is the Midnight Essence and its relationship to, in Yumi's case, nightmares, but also to light weaving.
Yes, there was a word of Brandon about the Midnight Essence. Let's just kind of go down the list of different words of Brandon and kind of how they apply to each one. The Midnight Essence, Rasharan in nature, sometimes.
Yeah, I think maybe it's more accurate to say the Midnight Mother is Rasharan, and perhaps Midnight Essence is
the broader term.
Yeah, the universal, because in our Tress episode, we talked a bit about how these are all tapping into a Cosmere-wide force or quality or something like that. This midnight thing is inherent to the Cosmere and is popping up in different ways around the Cosmere, like we see with Midnight Spores. So that's how I would break it down, at least right now, would be like Midnight Mother is specifically Rasharan, Midnight Essence is maybe more broad, and then Light Weaving is specifically Rasharan.
And to the question of the Midnight Essence, Brandon said that it has a prefixed personality that is not necessarily present in nightmares or light weaving. So it's a distinct personality that kind of comes along with the Midnight Essence. And I think we felt that personality through the Midnight Spores and the bond that Tress had with it.
Which is so interesting. The idea that there is a personality attached to this Cosmere-wide force or presence that always shows up wherever Midnight Essence appears. And this came up in questions around Yumi because, of course, the nightmares and the shroud have some similarities to Midnight Essence, but Brandon said that they are not the same, not coming from that same place, because they do not have that same prefixed personality that is the hallmark of Midnight Essence.
So let's build into the next one. Light weaving, Rasharan specific in the instance that we are talking about.
Sort of similar to the nightmares, where it can take investiture and make it shaped and move and corporeal. Things like this. Yeah, corporeal.
But light weaving is distinct in that it is capable of having mass. Brandon said, quote, imagine a bunch of stormlight becoming tangible, end quote. That concept of capable of having mass is maybe not unique, but is distinct to light weaving. And I think that we have seen that in action. Shallan, Battle of Thalen Fields, giving some of the mass and more of herself to her light weavings that were protecting them in that instance. And I think there's a lot more to kind of understand about light weaving.
Totally.
Certainly the connection between light, sound, and physicality or matter, you know, the actual dense mass. There is some aspect that Brandon's certainly leading us towards about how those things are all connected and kind of move between one another. Light weaving is just the best and clearest example of that in effect right now.
Yeah. And then for Yumi, with the nightmares and the shroud, he compared it to being a light weaving that has become anonymous, but also has broken down a little bit, plus a cognitive shadow. So an autonomous, broken light weaving plus cognitive shadow.
Yeah, this is a seemingly crazy description, but if we actually kind of work with it and look at other examples, I think that Kelsier/Thydakar is something similar here, or at least that could have been a trans...
You think he's more similar to a nightmare?
No, I think he is most similar because he's a cognitive shadow, right, in Mistborn's Secret History. Mm-hmm. And so he would be the cognitive shadow bit in the same way that Liyun, the guardian and teacher of Yumi, is the cognitive shadow. Kelsier starts as the cognitive shadow, and then he goes through a transition that we think eventually gets him a physical body. Mm-hmm. But if instead of getting that physical body, he attached himself to a nightmare, a kind of broken light weaving, it's almost like he is the spren that is affixing himself and filling in the gaps of the broken thing instead of a Kaladin. In this case, it is a nightmare or a partially formed nightmare, you know, the kind of like fog-esque nightmares.
The concept of it being similar to a light weaving, I think, is interesting, especially with the knowledge that light weaving can have mass. Who's to say that the body we see Thydakar in is not a light weaving or something similar?
Yeah, I think that that's a good call out and a good point, because we also know that the Aeons are probably more connected over to Scadrial to start with. We don't know, want to say far future of the Cosmere, but I think that that connection between Elantris and we kind of see on Rashar pattern acting similar to the Aeon, kind of like moving around, but he has the light weaving attached to him and he like gives it movement a little bit. I think that theoretically an Aeon could perform that role as well, and it could like hold the light weaving. If Thydakar is a light weaving, that's maybe how he would do it without a
I don't know if that would be necessary.
I'm just saying like something it needs to be happening that's like providing both elements, the quote-unquote light weaving and the quote-unquote cognitive shadow. Sure,
and we know that Thydakar doesn't currently have any powers.
Yes, and so I don't think he's casting a light weaving, but maybe something else could do a light weaving-esque, and the Aeon jumped out to me as like the possibility. So if he was like holding an Aeon in a box that was casting a light weaving around him.
Okay, so maybe not. This
it's a long stretch, yeah, but this not. Is what storming theories is all about. We have to go to the brink, maybe past the brink. Maybe we jump right off the cliff and join Kelsier in becoming Thydakar. But I also think that these nightmares, the true nightmares that we see in Yumi, are the cognitive shadow, like Liyun, that has attached themselves to a broken light weaving. That's the description we have.
I like the comparison with Vasher's description of cognitive shadows. Brandon gave us this little breakdown with that passage as a touchstone. Basically, you know, Vasher has his little fossil that he is showing Kaladin to sort of try to describe cognitive shadows. And like the fossil, the cognitive shadow, there is a pattern or an imprint of the creature that once was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then power or investiture can kind of make that imprint manifest and be able to interact with the world. When the personality attached to the imprint asserts itself and the power is in the right place, then the personality is able to run, so to speak, the cognitive shadow. So I think this would be like a Kelsier, where not only is there an imprint of who this person was, there's also power that's attached to that imprint. And then Kelsier, the personality, is aware enough to be able to assert itself on that powerful imprint.
And I think that Rashard gives us examples with the Heralds, as well as just Spren themselves, the concept of human ideas or people's conscious ideas and concepts becoming and reinforcing and maybe fueling the power behind a Thydakar in this example. Like Kelsier exists beyond himself. His fossil actually imprinted upon the foundation of New Skadrial. Like everything after the Katacendra is fossilized in part by Kelsier, quote unquote, the survivor. And that's why we see him in Religions. It would make sense. He's not quite a herald, but it would make sense if the power of their religion was actually kind of giving fuel, giving life to Kelsier Thydakar.
Yeah, I think we're still waiting to see, to hear how that is working in the Cosmere. We speculated about it a lot, but we haven't gotten any kind of confirmation that anything like that is happening.
And I think so, it will come in the form of Stormlight Archive 5. We'll actually learn the Heralds because of what we got with Rhythm of War and the kind of revelations that we learned about the Heralds with Ishar and Kallak. I assume we're going to get more about the Heralds that will inform us if something unique is going on with Kelsier Thydakar as well.
Maybe. And then on Komashi, Brennan said that we've got this mass of power and energy that the machine is controlling. And the machine kind of pulls back and is able to override the personality sometimes. So what we see with Liyun is the assertion of that personality occasionally. And then obviously sometimes the machine is able to suppress the personality.
Yeah, the concept has been mentioned many times by both our patrons as well as you normal listeners out there about the similarity between the machine and Nightblood, and specifically the shroud that is created having a similarity to Nightblood's black smoke that he gives off. And with Jen Neal and the Tress Storming Theories episode we did, I think that we also kind of made these connections between, like, what exactly is that byproduct, and that is it an inefficiency in the use of some investiture or some, you know, matter that can't be broken down, and so it's just like released as black smoke or as the shroud on Yumi. We need to, I think, really focus on when we see these things across the Cosmere, because there's a couple of other instances. I'm thinking with Yasna, who we know is going to be a narrator down the road in the Stormlight Archive, but her power of transformation also seems to have a Smokey-esque byproduct that I would just say could be what's happening on a smaller scale than the machine or Nightblood that we see in later. But I do imagine these things are kind of connected in some ways, that there's a little like waste or some inefficiency, and then that kind of like bursts out. And if we understand the one, if we understand the small scale, we might actually be able to learn about the large scale, which could unlock some mystery.
Yeah. Brandon has said that Nightblood is significantly linked to Midnight Essence and Nightmares. So he didn't say there was a connection to the Father Machine and Nightblood, but he did say that that black smoke that we see in Nightblood, Nightmares, and Midnight Essence can maybe an indication of warped investiture.
A bunch of things to keep in mind as we go forward and hopefully see some of the unmaids and the Midnight Mother specifically come back into the forefront in Stormlight Archive 5.
Yeah, honestly, I more hope that we get more unmade information in Stormlight 5 versus more Herald information.
Oh, I feel like that's a hot take.
I feel like having more knowledge of the unmade would just unlock more things than the Heralds at this point.
That is perhaps something we should bring up in a different episode, because I do think there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the unmade. Let's stay more focused on Yumi specifically, because we now have this scale and this hierarchy that is really important when it comes to answering the question, who is the most powerful person in the Cosmere?
Yeah, I do think it's helpful to know like what the scale is and how these people compare across the Cosmere. Brandon was specifically asked about the Yokihijo versus Elantrians versus Heralds. And in the text, the order is described as Yumi is the most powerful, Elantrians are slightly less powerful than Yumi, and the Returned are less powerful than the Elantrians. And someone asked Brandon, where do the Heralds fall in this scale?
And Brandon responded, as he often does, with a long answer, discussing how the Heralds can vary in their power level depending how, quote, in line with the power of honor, how in line with the kind of natural investiture of Rishar, which is separate from honor, cultivation, and odium, are they? And how can they draw upon that, end quote. I feel like he snuck in this line just to, like, his brain, like, went down a quick rabbit hole and he was like, maybe I should go back to the original question. But he just gave a aside that goes like this, how in line with the kind of natural investiture of Rishar, which is separate from honor, cultivation, and odium. What do you think about that specifically?
My brain exploded. Like, what? The natural investiture of Rishar is different from the shards that exist on Rishar. I think we've had in the past some soft confirmation that ad nauseum had visited Rishar and that some of the Spren, or at least some of the power creating the Spren, came from ad nauseum and existed before the shards came to that planet. So maybe that is what this is, but I'm also thinking, could this be connected or referring to what they call the old magic on Rishar?
Yeah, because the old magic has so often been linked with cultivation. And the concept we always felt was a little bit muddied purposefully to kind of like cause chaos in the reader.
Strongly connected to the Night Watcher.
Right.
Who is connected to cultivation. But I think there's always been this question of, is that really cultivation's power, or is there something more similar to surge binding and void binding that comes from cultivation? And like, how does this fit in? Because it doesn't really seem to fit in with our known structures on Rishar. I really like this idea that the old magic is a vestige of the time before the shards came to the planet, whether that is directly from ad nauseum or something else entirely. I don't know, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, because my understanding, I guess the poetic description of what had happened is that ad nauseum in some form, you know, be it great because he art thou God, came and walked on Rishar. And in the wake of his stroll across the planet, there was birthed the Spren of Rishar. But we know that the listeners are a native species to the planet, and that they have the ability, you know, in the name of listening, is that they can hear the true tones of Rishar.
Mm-hmm.
But the true tones of Rishar, as we understand them right now, are the tones of honor, cultivation, and odium.
Right.
And maybe how they work together, how they work apart. But it's those three tones. Brandon is saying here there's something else. There's the natural investiture of Rashar that I think is what the listeners are actually listening to originally. They are listening to their planet before any of the shards exist. But then when the shards drop onto the planet, their power is so potent. It's like the drums have been dropped into maybe like a light flute, or just even the natural sound of a stream going by. Like that's the quote unquote music that existed when the listeners were on the planet. And then the shards drop in.
Yeah.
And it's just like full instruments. And so then it becomes the orchestra of these three shards eventually, and like the humans and everything is kind of going on simultaneously. The listeners to me have a little bit of everything. The listeners to me would have made the best heralds if what is necessary to be a herald is to be in line with either honor cultivation and the natural investiture of Rashar,
sure,
because they would have had that one on lock. And then it's just a question of, can you also listen to these new shards, which we know they can, because they change forms based on the true tones of Rashar. I know I just threw a bunch at you, but really what I want to come through is I think the listeners would be, make the best heralds.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for bringing it back to our original topic. I could have gone down that side street forever.
But I've circled this around. We did a cul-de-sac or a little loop-de-loop, and we're right back where we started.
Okay, so the heralds are, as Brandon says, the least invested of this group because they can vary in their power level. So sort of on average, least invested. If you have a herald who, like maybe Talm, maybe he's so powerful because he's like perfectly in line with honor and
that would make sense.
The natural investiture and stuff.
Yeah.
But because there is variation, heralds are at the bottom of our power scale.
And then we have the returned, clearly above them, the Elantrians, and then Yumi is actually distinct in the concept of a Yokihijo.
Right, exactly. So she is not representative of all Yokihijo, and Brandon did say that she's pretty close to Elantrians, and in fact, most Yokihijo in history were less invested than Elantrians, and because Yumi and I presume her Yokihijo sisters, who are still alive, are all extra powerful because they've gained investiture over the time that they've been alive. Well, I guess I shouldn't say alive, but around.
Certainly around.
And they've been around for a very long time.
And they have used that time when it comes to Yumi to like perfecting her art of rock stacking. And that, I think, kind of like doubling down on your purpose is probably what allowed her to elevate herself.
Sure.
Especially if it is in line with virtuosity, her shard. So instead of talking about Rashar, we bring it back. Yumi is basically the Talm, or Yumi is basically, in my example, the listener, who is perfectly in line with her power source in virtuosity, as well as her natural planet of Kamashi, as she's literally building art out of the planet itself.
Yeah, I love that. I'm so glad we were able to tie those together so nicely.
It wasn't easy, and I don't know if it's correct, but I hope that
I think it's good. That's a good
follow
speculation.
The trail, yes, that we went on.
Okay, and then those were kind of the big things. Here are some little snacks for us, info about things that we may have previously speculated about in Yumi and some new info that we have. For example, there are a couple of off-world words that are used on Kamashi that we talked a bit about in our original series. For example, the suffix Nimi to show honor. It's an honorific. And also the eating utensil, my pawn sticks. And Brandon has said that these are not necessarily words that they are actually using on Kamashi. They are words that Hoid has chosen when telling this story because of his audience. And so he has chosen to use the honorific Nimi because it's a phrase that Shin people specifically would recognize as an honorific. And so we can assume that not only is his audience Rosharan, but the audience is specifically Shin.
That's a great bit of deductive reasoning, and it reminds me a lot of Tolkien's description of writing The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, as well as The Silmarillion, his kind of like Middle Earth universe, from his perspective, was an ancient mythical world that he had discovered descriptions of, like tomes, and that he was translating these books, mm-hmm. these stories, into words that we humans on our realm or in our realm would recognize. And so when there were linguistic similarities, it wasn't always the case that like the specific word choice was important, because it was a translation of right. the ancient text. It was like, this is for you, the reader, rather than it is how the hobbits or the elves were actually speaking. Brandon's doing a little bit of the same thing. He's saying, this is Hoyd's word selection for the audience that he is speaking to.
Right.
I find, in a very meta sense, outside the actual work itself, this to be fascinating from an artist's perspective, a creator's perspective, where you're not inventing everything. You are translating it. Brandon, in this instance, is merely recording what Hoyd said.
Yeah.
Because Hoyd is the one who made this choice, because Hoyd is speaking to the Shin.
Yeah.
It's not Brandon creating the Cosmere. It's Brandon recording what Hoyd had demonstrated or performed to an audience of Shin people. And that little mental trick that Tolkien and Brandon are doing, I think, is indicative of a bit of greatness. Like, how do you push beyond the kind of mere mortals and enter into the next realm of like a creative artwork? Is you have to kind of tell yourself that you are not the source of this, that the source is kind of outside of you.
Sure, yeah.
And that helps you continue forth, because it's not so daunting as saying, like, I'm going to create everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just, yeah. I need to translate this.
It takes, like, the effort out of it.
A little bit, yes.
From feeling like, you have to, like, work really hard to create something, and it makes it a little bit more passive, where you can maybe be a little bit more meditative.
Yes.
And just kind of wait and listen and see what comes.
Yeah, because something is always out there, right? It's not for you to go out and create.
It's a very, like, Greek, the muses are speaking to me.
Yeah.
Stephen, type of philosophy.
Stephen Pressfield, who wrote The War of Art, talks about it in that sense. Exactly. The muse is out there, and you need to do what is necessary to connect with your muse.
Yeah.
And then that's what allows you to be productive.
And I don't know what Tolkien's work schedule was like, but there is an element of you have to show up and sort of do the proper rituals mm-hmm. for the muses to come to you. You can't have a lot of expectation of them. They're goddesses. Like, you have to do your part, go to your office or, you know, the shrine of the muses, so yes. to speak, sit down, like, do your quote unquote rituals of typing on your keyboard or whatever your writing exercises are, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do those things, you will be inspired.
Yeah, that's certainly Brandon's focus. Other, you know, great authors of the modern era, like Stephen King, have a focus that is similar. Tolkien, I think, loved, you know, to have his coffee dates with C.S. Lewis and philosophize. But he's also writing and creating the languages that he is, in quotes, translating.
Right. Yes.
Like, he's doing all that work in the background. So he's like feeding himself this tale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because language is so tied up in our culture and our history and our stories, and diving into language tells you so much about a people that if that's your in, like, studying a language or creating a language will force you to come up with the culture, the background, etc.
Yeah, so that's what I feel like we should be on the lookout, especially if it's a Hoyd story or a new story or even the interludes in Stormlight Archive 5. If there's language shifts, that could tell you a lot about the audience as well as the speaker, and kind of using that as context clues as we go forward.
Also remembering that when Hoyd is telling stories in Stormlight Archive, for example, kind of thinking about how he is changing or adjusting stories like The Girl Who Looked Up or Fleet or whatever it is for the audience. And then how do we like peel that layer back to get to more of the truth of those stories?
Yes. The dog and the dragon is told on a world where there are right. no dogs.
Right. Yeah. In that case, he actually does not change the story to be applicable for his audience. He's like, just trust me, bro.
Yeah. He's just like, it's the nicest thing you can imagine. It's way better than anything you have on your planet.
You literally can't imagine it because it's so good.
We agree. Tell me some more about Yumi as a person, as a cognitive shadow, as this superpowered entity throughout the Cosmere.
A fun fact about Yumi is that despite the fact that she is so heavily invested, she is able to travel off world. Brandon said, quote, she's a cognitive shadow, much like the Heralds or Vasher, that is more self-sustaining because of how highly she is invested. Imagine someone like Vasher with thousands of breaths, end quote. And yet, apparently she would not really have trouble getting off of Kamashi.
I think that's of note because we also saw Kamashi invent or use some space travel.
Space travel for the first time.
And I think that after the Sunlit Man, our understanding of the timeline of where those things kind of take place, that there's certainly an Iron Station 7 and probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. I'm guessing one of those is around Kamashi, keeping an eye on their development, their planet jumping. That would like send off some alarms. If I'm chilling on the Iron Station 7, if someone new joins the space realm, I'm taking note of that type of thing. I think this is particularly interesting because Vasher did have thousands of breaths. For a while, Vasher was holding way more breaths. You know, he had like the God King's breaths, not forever. It's not as if he was chilling with all 50,000 breaths, but like assuming that he did everything to set up that story, I thought breaths would make it harder to leave. Brandon is almost saying like breaths would make it easier for Vasher to leave.
No, I think those are two separate ideas. One is a description of how invested Yumi is. And then even though she is that invested, she would be able to travel off-world, perhaps easier than we see the Heralds or Kelsier being able to.
Right. I thought the Heralds being so invested, Kelsier being so invested, would have more trouble leaving because it's like more investiture waiting
them
down.
So Yumi is the outlier. She's weird. Kelsier would love to meet Yumi and be
figure
like,
it out.
How can I hack you to become more like you?
Yes, he definitely would want that. That would probably shortchange everything that's going to happen in Stormlight Archive.
Yeah, he's spending all this time on Roshar when really he should be on Kamashi questioning Yumi.
And it's probably the case that the self-sustaining aspect is key. There is some...
Oh, maybe.
Because that's what it's talking about. She's like a Herald or Vasher, but she's more self-sustaining because of how... So she's surpassed the point where investiture acts as a rock. Oh, kind of like how Jupiter is 98.8% of a sun. If it just had a little bit more mass, it would actually collapse and into a sun.
Okay.
And then it would just start exploding in a continuous cycle and lots of bad stuff would happen here in the Milky Way galaxy. But that's not important. What is important is that there's kind of like a breaking point where you can go from being a gas giant really, really big, hanging out, but still a planet, if you continued to gain mass, like you ate Saturn, if Jupiter ate Saturn because they were closer together and eventually one just rolled into the next one, that would actually be more mass than is necessary to collapse in on itself and create a self-sustaining sun. In my estimation, Yumi has surpassed that. She is self-sustaining. She's a nuclear reactor unto herself. And so now there are no limits.
Nobody can hold her down.
Yes, basically she has become Elsa from Frozen and she is just letting it all go because she is powered unto herself. Let me know if you think this is too crazy of a call out, or has Yumi gone beyond Jupiter?
I'm curious if it's more a matter of the fact that her shard is shattered. Maybe that changes the way that the investiture on her planet works.
It kind of like and allows less her. Attaches her.
Right. Yeah. There's not the same constant, steady infusion of investiture on the planet. Maybe. We don't really know what's happened with Virtuosity. So this is all just speculation. But I'm curious if that is playing a part in her ability to leave the planet more easily than other highly invested entities.
If my theory would state that she is impacted by Virtuosity's shatteredness, it may have allowed her to gain so much investiture in the first place. It would be maybe abnormal, and certainly is abnormal across the Cosmere. Yeah. Think about how many restrictions, honor, and cultivation placed on the heralds.
Right.
Just to invest them many levels down lower than Returned and the Elantrians, and certainly the Yokihijo in general, and Yumi specifically. So there were a lot more restrictions. Maybe Virtuosity's breaking is what gave Yumi the ability to keep gaining investiture.
There's another interesting quality of Yumi's investiture that we've seen elsewhere across the Cosmere. We see that her investiture and her memory are linked, and they can be linked across the Cosmere. We have seen this in Warbreaker, when Vasher takes a memory away from a little girl using some investiture. We see this, of course, at the end of Stormlight 4, when Hoid gets his memories taken by Odium. And Yumi is another example of this happening as she forgets each day as she lives it and continues to live the same day over and over again.
She certainly is trapped in that state for a very long time, though eventually does break out because of assistance from others and kind of the influence of others, which is why I think probably the worst thing for the Heralds was to isolate themselves and to step away from humanity to stop, because it disconnected their connection to others in a really key and probably important way for maintaining their sanity, yes,
sure,
but also like maintaining their power source kind of in a balanced fashion.
That's interesting. Brandon gave us a little detail about this connection between memory and investiture by saying that in order to change memory with investiture, it requires a lot of precision when doing this. Not anyone can just, you know, fumble around and grab your memories through your investiture. It has to be extremely precise, or else the body will sort of acknowledge what's happening and reject it and push you out if you're trying to do that. So this tells us, I mean, I don't think it's surprising in terms of Vasher. He's been around for so long. It's not surprising to think that he would have this very niche skill. But I think it flags in my mind for Odium, specifically Terravodium, who has just recently become a shard, that he already was able to successfully perform this skill with Hoid.
Of note, though, and I think this is the key example, with Hoid, he does two things, which is erases the short-term memory that Hoid has of the meeting, and B, changes the memories that Hoid stored externally, that he put into his investiture, that were not, to be like really precise, the things inside of his own brain. It was like an external hard drive.
Do you think that there's a difference?
I do think that there's a difference. I think, importantly,
and for Yumi, they're just all in investiture because she's a cognitive shadow. She doesn't have a brain to keep memories in.
No physical body. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there would be basically what Odium and why Odium was able to impact Hoid is because he was targeting two things: short-term memory, which is easier to wipe, in my guess.
Okay.
And B, the external hard drive made up of investiture, which now as Odium, he is. And therefore has a better understanding and grip instantly of like how to manipulate investiture.
Yeah.
Even if it's like we learn in Scadrial with Reshek when he takes up the power of ruin, that there's kind of a, I know what I want to do and I know I have the power to do it. And then maybe I go too far. You know, maybe I push too hard or one thing or the other. But it, from Odium's perspective, was more in line. He kind of like knew what he wanted to do, impact these memories, and he had the ability to do so as a full shard rather than a splinter. His grip of his power is just so much greater than anything else that we're seeing, even a Vasher. Like, it takes expertise for a splinter, for a herald, for a Vasher level character, but the Odium example is just a little bit easier for him to do.
Yeah.
Is my
guess.
That
makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Speaking of shards, virtuosity, what the heck is going on with virtuosity? A question was posed to Brandon, what was she doing between the shattering, aka her birth, the birth of virtuosity about 10,000 years ago, and her splintering about 1,700 years ago?
And Brandon said, quote, virtuosity was exploring the artistic expressions of the Cosmere and choosing not to settle in one location, something that virtuosity was not keen on doing, not for too long at least, end quote.
Could virtuosity be the shard that was trying to hide and survive?
That's a very interesting call. Certainly the nomadic lifestyle of virtuosity also kind of goes along with what some of us humans would have seen, nomadic and artistic people. I'm thinking of like traveling troops and a group of people that are going around to perform and create and never really settling in one place because they don't quite fit into the traditional mold of society. That's virtuosity. She's a little bit of the kind of like 1970s hippie who's just like going from here to there and just like finding artwork, creating, which to me means that she could have been a bunch of places, including on other major shard worlds.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think we should expect that virtuosity has at least seen all of the planets where there is life, because if there's life, there is creation happening, and virtuosity would like that. Then I think there's a question of, when did she come to Kamashi? Why did she come to Kamashi? And why did she choose this location to shatter herself? Don't know. That's the question. It's not that she was just hanging out on Kamashi and this was her home, and so obviously she also died there, but it seems to me like there was maybe more purpose in the choice to be here specifically.
I agree. I think that there was a choice. I think that choice is very beyond our understanding right now, but to continue with my allegory, continue with my metaphor.
Okay.
The hippie arrives at their final destination, you don't have any type of ability to understand what they're thinking or how they're going to behave or how they're going to act, because their life is so varied. They've seen the entire Cosmere, maybe more so than any other shard.
Maybe, yeah.
And has a perspective that we can't even understand. They're beyond us, man. They're understanding their
She's
existence.
She's seen some things.
Exactly. She's seen everything. And does that make you hopeful? Does it make you like tragic and depressed? I don't know. It could go literally any way. She could have shattered herself out of hatred for everything that was going on in the Cosmere. She could have shattered herself knowing that that would trigger events that would connect in ways that only an artist can see, that like all of these strands were going to come together and weave a beautiful thing.
Maybe she wanted all of the pieces of herself to flow out throughout the Cosmere.
Maybe so it would be better.
There could be more virtuosity everywhere.
Exactly. I think that what you and Jen brought up last time in our Tress episode was that how could shattering Ada Nauseam be good for Ada Nauseam? That seems like only a bad thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, the we were doing this for your own good was just a lie. You know, it had to be about something else other than it directed to a person or an entity that is holding Ada Nauseam. But what if what you just said is true? If that spreading virtuosity throughout the Cosmere, even in tiny little splinters and tiny little fragments, is quote unquote better than a single virtuosity as a shard.
Mm-hmm.
maybe the same could be said about Ada Nauseam.
No.
I agree. It's not. Okay. It's not actually better, but I think that could be the argument, that they are making a small-scale argument for virtuosity to break apart, splinter herself, go across the
just don't think they're similar enough that you could compare the two things.
And I'm not going to push that hard on it, but I want everyone to let us know what you think when it comes to, can breaking a shard or breaking all of Ada Nauseam into a bunch of shards, can that actually be a net positive? Or is it always going to be a negative to have the destruction or the splintering of a shard? Hit me up with your thoughts. We're everywhere. We got the snail mail. We got the regular email. We got Threads, Instagram. We're all over the place. Find us. Let us know what you think.
Let's go to some of the art happening on Kamashi, because there is a connection between the painting and the rock stacking that we see on Kamashi and the art, some might say, of trapping Spren in Fabrials. There's an element of luring the cognitive entity, the power entity, with something that they want. Obviously, on Kamashi, the thing that they want is virtuosity, is masterful creation, whether that comes in painting or rock stacking. And on Rishar, we see that happening with elements, so heat and water and things like that, to attract the Spren in order to create the Fabrial.
Interestingly, on Rishar with the Spren, there can also be emotions that evoke and create and draw in the Spren. I'm thinking of the pain reel as a specific example, where you can both turn up and turn down the feeling you have of pain. To capture that Spren, what did you have to do? I imagine you had to create pain. You had to draw them in with the thing that they want, that they react to, which would be physical pain.
Yeah.
And yes, that can be horrifying when you think about like using that as a bait. But so too, you know, it's pretty horrifying to take a worm and put it on a hook and then to throw that guy off the back of your boat and then to bait in a fish.
I think that something they are going to start moving towards on Rishar is how to have more consensual Fabrials.
Yes.
In the same way that on Kamashi, after all of the events of the story, the spirits decide of their own accord to stay, to keep being high on lines, to keep making television for them, because they are also getting something out of it. I think there's a way that also happens on Rishar, where Artifabrians are able to have a partnership with Spren in creating these devices, which is also something, it's so similar to what Yumi does in the pre times, mm-hmm. and we see a facsimile of it during the story when she does her virtuosic rock stacking. She's able to convince the spirits to create Fabrials, basically to be little devices for people and like to help out. And that's the exchange that happens. They show up, they're like, wow, we are so appreciative of your virtuosic rock stacking that we will serve in exchange.
Yeah, serve or work together. That would kind of like be the next step. There is a element of like slavery being the worst case scenario, a service industry.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting paid.
Right.
In virtuosity.
In the thing that they want.
Yeah.
Very true. I still think that there is like an inequality in that situation in our own world. This would be like Marxism. A basic inequality exists. And that's the functioning factor that we have in on display in capitalist structure, is taking advantage of that inequality. And then a Marxist or communist society would be that everyone is equal, everything is equal, and they share resources equally. But right now in the Cosmere, they might not be at that utopia level. They are at a lower tier level when they're kind of just like moving up out of slavery in most instances. And I think Spren are a great example of this on display, is because we can see radical changes where they kind of bring Spren up to what they consider to be their moral line between one another.
Would you not consider the Nahel bond to be equal footing?
I think the Nahel Bond might be equal footing theoretically, but right now it's not. That there is a structure that's placed around the Nahel Bond by honor and cultivation that is very much about protection and war and kind of like reinforcing the negative ideas that got Rishar into the place Maybe. That it is today.
But if you just take Kaladin and Syl, for example, like Syl is showing up as a shard spear or a shard blade because she wants to, basically. You know, like they're in relationship. And so there is an exchange. There's always an exchange in any kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that she is a slave to Kaladin or less than Kaladin in any way. In fact, there are times when she refuses to do what Kaladin wants her to.
And
if his side of the relationship is not being upheld.
I think that Syl is surpassing the expectations that we would normally set and that their society would normally set.
You don't think that all of the other Nahel Bonds are functioning the same way? You think
if we look at the
pattern is more subservient?
No, don't take the specific examples that we know are like Brandon's writing about. Look at the norm in most instances, both now and in the past. Look at how the other honor spren act and behave. And I think that Syl stands out as different. And that might just be how they've broken it down with the structure of the ideals, and that the full nature of a spren is actually unlocking itself as well as you move up in the ideals. And so by the time they are a fourth and fifth ideal Night Radiant, there is an equanimity between the two. And that's kind of like what you're working towards. But just a normal spren, be it an honor spren, wind spren, whatever, is not equal to the mortal on the planet. It is only through the bond that they are kind of like allowed to exist on the same tier. And that's weird to me.
I disagree. I think that the bond is the ideal version of what you're saying, of trying to create equality between spren and mortals on the planet, which is going to be different from the elemental spren. I'm not sure how we get equality for, you know, wind spren and grass spren and life spren or whatever.
But like with the spirits on Kamashi, we assume that they do want that. They do want some type of equality. They don't want to be treated as slaves. They don't want
but
to
I think
be tortured.
They get that at the end.
I think that we need more kind of like understanding. If there is, you know, I could just make the same argument about workers' rights. Just be like, are they being paid equal? Is there discrepancies in their pay versus the human pay? Do you have the same laws set around the spirits that you do around the humans, around the spren, so on and so forth? And I think right now, the answer in all of these worlds would be like, no, they don't treat those things as equal. There's clear distinctions.
But I think you also
differences.
Can't because
you
they
might
are
be right about
not
that.
The same.
Yeah, no, no. Like, that's very true.
If you offered to like pay the spirits money, they would be like, we don't want that. Why would you give us a coin? Like, what am I, a spirit, going to do with a coin? They are getting what they want, which is the virtuosity and to watch television dramas. That's
they
all
really
they want.
Love that
That's
stuff.
Their payment.
Great things to speculate about. Let's go over to some darker speculation. Let's talk about the Father Machine.
The tyrant of Komashi. We talked a lot about what it means to be an awakened machine. Is this a case of potentially outworlders coming to Komashi and building this father machine with Nalthus technology or something like that? And we've seen this word awakened used throughout the secret projects and starting to be used a lot more often Cosmere-wide. And Brandon has given a little bit of clarification on how that word can be used and how awakened starts to refer to not just Nalthian breath magic, but also any type of invested technology, basically, can be called awakened in a general sense. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it was created using breaths.
This is certainly going to be a bit confusing going forward. I think it's here to introduce a little bit of similar linguistics, as we were talking about earlier with Tolkien, but also to kind of simplify what is already a ever-expanding list of things that you need to remember and understand. If you can just have one phrase in a general sense in the future Cosmere of awaken and have that be understood, that like this machine is awaken, that means this, but it doesn't necessarily tie to each one of the specific magic systems. Mm-hmm. I think it's freeing up the creative possibilities without getting bogged down in some
of and trying to create too much vocabulary.
Yes, you would need like Elantrian awakened, Risharan awakened, awaken, Skadrian, right. Awaken. But you need a word for each of those.
What happens when you start to combine magic systems? And like, then what do you call it?
Yeah, because I think the ships that we were talking about in Tress, and certainly when we were doing the Word of Brandon, talking about the far future of the Cosmere, those are going to be combining different machines. There's no reason for us to think that an awakened machine from Nalthus is the only way to achieve X result.
Right.
And they're going to start figuring out how to best combine different machines. You're going to get a little piece from somewhere on the Cosmere, and that's going to be incorporated into the ship or into the computer or whatever they happen to be building.
When it comes to the father machine, Brandon confirmed that it is extra broken magic and that its brokenness is what enables it to be able to suck all of the souls from such a large distance. Brandon said, quote, "This is a side effect of what virtuosity did, and a bit of virtuosity and all the people allowing the machine to have enough of a plausible connection to them to draw upon them," end quote.
Yeah, we always knew there was something a little bit strange about what was happening. Nightblood being a key example, it requires physical touch. He has to come out of the sheath. He has to touch you and kind of like draw
and
directly.
Can't kill everyone within a 100-yard radius or whatever. It's much more contained.
Exactly. But the father machine has a capital C connection, a plausible enough one, and then he's broken enough to kind of see the plausible as like, oh yeah, that's guaranteed. Like, we'll just reach right across. Everybody else is like, that's kind of a wavy bridge, maybe just a couple of strings between a canyon. And the father machine's like, no, I'm gonna walk right across that. Just like, grab you on the
really
other side.
Not really supposed to work like that, but okay.
Yeah, something about the brokenness allows him to see that connection as all that is required to draw upon them. I think the shroud and kind of the excess that we discussed may be an example of how that's not perfect. If it was less broken, there would be less waste.
Yeah, as we were talking about at the very beginning of this episode, that shroud possibly being an indicator of warped or otherwise not great investiture.
Let's jump over to an interesting question, not about the father machine, but about the Hyon lines themselves.
Have you seen this talk online about the investiture in Yumi being related to the CMYK, like printer ink color?
So there's a lot of stuff going on, but the printer ink color that you're talking about used on the actual hardcovers that we got in the mail, right?
Yes. So obviously we have cyan and magenta as the main colors of Yumi, and the normal person among us may recognize those as some of the major colors of printer ink. If you ever have to buy your printer ink, you buy cyan, magenta, yellow, and black.
Yeah. Need all of those just to print in black, for the record. We don't know why.
Yeah.
HP really needs you to understand that cyan is important to printing black.
Yeah. And so, of course, when Yumi came out, the question was like, okay, well, we have cyan and magenta, and we do have a lot of black things. Where the heck is yellow? And Lacrosse Demon asked, in the Yumi and the Nightmare Painter pre-release spoiler stream, someone asked about a third Hyon colored yellow, which you hinted was a thing. Nothing like that appeared in the novel beyond the third color on the cover artwork. Could you expand on that a bit?
Brandon says, quote, there could be a third theoretical color that would be relevant in this conversation, and it would be yellow if there were a third high online. It would be yellow. And there is not a third high online currently. I wonder why. End quote.
And there are some really great people speculating online. I love a lot of the theories and thoughts that people have come up with. Haze Killer in particular is a user who came up with some excellent speculation that basically boils down to the father machine is breaking the investiture into three parts, yellow, cyan, magenta, and it is eating the yellow or using the yellow as its power.
Exactly.
And then it spits out the cyan and magenta as the high on lines.
I love this one because I always had this question of what is actually continually powering the father machine.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, he's giving off the shroud, which is like waste. The high on lines are coming out seemingly great for everyone else to use as power. What is keep, because he needs the first burst of energy, which we see on the small scale. And, you know, that initiated, we learn, initiated the father machine consumption of everyone. But he's just, how's he keep going? There's no more people to keep consuming.
Well, it uses the spirits. It stacks rocks, attracts spirits, and uses the spirit investiture, I think. But
in this example,
there
the
has
haze
to be
killer,
something consumed.
Yes, exactly. So he's like drawing in the spirits, quote unquote, consuming them, spitting out shroud, two high on lines. But Haze Killer is saying, nay, it is three high on lines.
Right.
And one is used as the fuel source for the father machine.
Yeah. And then there was some additional speculation kind of related to that in the functioning just in general of investiture on Kamashi, that the Yokihijo are also using the yellow part of investiture to create the capital C connection that allows their spirit creations to maintain object permanence when they become Fabrials. And so yellow investiture would also be used to create the capital C connection between Yumi and Painter, which is why that those two figures appear yellow on the book cover.
This is such fun speculation just based on the fact that yellow existed on the book cover.
I love it so much.
There may even be a connection to the last moment of the book when Yumi is brought back into the real world by Painter. If they are, you know, the golden ones on the cover, and if the father machine is able to use the gold high on as power, perhaps that connection, the capital C connection that exists through everyone, is in the gold high on.
Yeah, it seems like yellow investiture is connected to capital C connection.
There it is.
In
yes.
some way.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best speculation that we have at this time, is that if there was a third high on line, it would be gold. It was being used by the father machine. When the father machine stopped using it, that could be why Yumi was able to bring herself back. She basically would have access to that thing that was previously.
Yellow has now become more available.
More available, exactly. And if it is connection in the same way, then it is Yumi's connection to others, to her friends at the coffee shop, to Painter himself. And it's that thing that kind of brings her into the real world and allows her to take form, which could be helpful in understanding the Heralds or Thydakar or any of these cognitive shadows playing in the future or with the future of the cosmic.
I find that such a helpful paradigm of investiture. I, as I've said many times, am not really a like science math person, but when you break it down into colors, I'm like, oh, I get it. I totally understand what's happening. And so I'm a little bit sad that we're not going to be on Kamashi probably anytime soon.
Yes, but hopefully we can get a trip back to Nalthus, the home of all the color.
Yeah.
And we have so much more in store in the build-up to the release of Stormlight Archive 5 later this year. Let us know what your thoughts are on how Yumi connects. If you learned anything in this episode, or if you had any great theories about Yumi and the Nightmare Painter, or any of the secret projects, we're definitely going to be looking at the Sunlit Man next, one of the most chock full of Cosmere connections. So get excited about that. And thank you so much for listening. Brooke, can you take us away?
Until next time, life before death,
strength before weakness,
journey before destination.